Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The most recent narrative change about the conflict in Ukraine is the following. It's a stalemate. Interestingly, there is some truth to this. Ukraine indeed faces a stalemate. It has limited options. On the other hand, Russia has many options. This worries Washington. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Tony Kevin in Canberra. He is a former Australian career diplomat. In Belgrade, we have Stephen Gajic. He's a research associate at Belgrade's Institute of European Studies. And in Budapest, we cross to George Samueli. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Mr. Former Ambassador Tony, let me go to you first here. You recently penned an article under the title, Is the End Game in Sight for Ukraine? And I'm going to paraphrase you a little bit. Ukraine has no options left, and Russia has plenty. Please explain that.
Well, Russia has military and political and psychological superiority of the Kiev regime. That has clearly been established since last September, and the retreat of the Kiev regime, in my opinion, has become a rout. Russia now controls the pace of military activity at the front. They can decide whether they wish to go forward or whether they wish to stay in place. They can mold special military encirclements in which the Ukrainians on the side are faced with the choice of either going forward and being killed, or not going forward and being seen to be a toothless army. Unfortunately, Zelensky wants them to go forward and be killed. And so we see an increasing decline in the military quality of Kiev's forces, a tragic decline, and no military result of any consequence. Now, if Russia wanted to go forward, they could. We're up against here Putin's own self-imposed limits, that he still regards Ukraine as in some way part of the Russian world. He's still trying to protect as much as he can of Ukraine's civil society and civil infrastructure. He's instructed his commanders only to take out what is necessary to take out in order to maintain clear military superiority. And he's hoping, I think rather desperately, although it's a good hope, I share this hope, that something will happen in Kiev to bring about a regime change, to achieve a more realistic, sensible regime with whom a realistic peace can be negotiated. So to sum up, he holds all the options, but yet he is constrained.
Well, you know, Stephen, let me go to you in Belgrade. It's really interesting they use the term stalemate, because I think the West has faced a stalemate in its thinking and its approach, because it's not achieving any of its policy aims. Because at the same time, and this is something that's contentious at times, my good friend George and I argue about this all the time, is that Russia steadily is degrading Ukraine's military. That is one of the primary objectives, and it is being done. Though those of us, well, not everyone is happy with the pace of it. So I tend to agree with the former ambassador that, you know, as I've asked before, who's got the clock and who has the time? And the Russians have both. Stephen, go ahead in Belgrade.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what we are dealing with now is the blame game. It is obvious that I wouldn't even say Ukraine. In many respects, Ukraine and even its army was an object of a proxy war that Washington is waging against Russia. And we see that now we don't know, you know, who is to be blamed. If Zelensky is not responsible, then it is NATO. Therefore, it seems to me that the West is trying to blame him for the defeat, and especially for the failed counteroffensive that took 200,000 Ukrainian soldiers either being killed or severely injured. So there are some really strange things happening in Kiev recently. Yep. Major Gennady Trastyakov was killed in his apartment, and he was the advisor to General Zaluzhny, commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian army. who is in a conflict with Zelensky because he had other ideas about how the war should be waged. And this is not the first time that things like this happen in Kyiv. Let me remind you all what happened at the beginning of the special military operation. After the first round of negotiations between Moscow and Kyiv, Denis Kiriev, who was one of the negotiating members of the negotiating team of the Kyiv side, of Ukrainian side, was murdered in cold blood.
Yep.
In front of his house, and nothing happened, nothing followed. So there are some really serious conflicts, and the source of these conflicts is the... as I said, the blame game.
Yeah, George, it's really interesting. You and I have done it on our podcast, kind of deciphering what's going on. It seems like some publications are denigrating Zelensky, pushing Zaluzhny, but then the other way around here. There is a blame game going on. There's a lot of panic going on. And of course, because of circumstances, Ukraine isn't always top of mind, if you know what I mean. George, you know, what do the tea leaves tell you, George?
Well, it's very hard to say because we know, obviously, that the Ukrainian counteroffensive has failed. However, Russia still has to win this war, and so Russia still has to achieve the objectives that it had set out on February the 24th of last year, which was demilitarization, denazification, the liberation of the Donbass. They haven't been achieved yet. So it's one thing to say that Ukraine clearly has failed in its counteroffensive, but then Russia has to then move forward and at the very minimum liberate Donbass. I mean, that has to be, and as well as Zaporozhye and Kherson. The difficulty is that there's nobody in Ukraine, no one in Kyiv, who is going to accept the minimum conditions that Russia would demand, which is that... you actually give up all your territorial claims on the Donbass and Zaporozhye and Kherson, you give up on Crimea, and you give up on NATO membership. It's very difficult to see how, I mean, the NATO membership, some of the United States and NATO are not going to give up on that goal, but it's hard to see how any regime can emerge in Kyiv that would accept those terms. So that's why, to be honest, I think this war will continue.
Yeah. George,
until there's a final decision.
Yeah, essentially, George, and we're both in agreement, there has to be a regime change or a different personality leading it. Let me go back to the former ambassador in Australia. Also, in the background of all of this, you know, feelers are being sent out. Anonymous sources say approaching Kyiv and members of the Zelensky circle. It's all kind of opaque here about, you know, who would be willing under what circumstances to have some kind of negotiation. The problem with this kind of cloak and dagger journalism that I've come across is it doesn't really take into account, will the Russians even want to negotiate with these people? Go ahead, in Australia.
Well, the answer is that the Russians would not want to negotiate with the very untrustworthy and pay a group of people who are running the show in Ukraine. I mean, these people are not serious. They are calmly and equably dealing with indifference to the fact that hundreds of their best men have gone dead or permanently incapacitated. They're now bringing forward the old and the weak and the lame, even pregnant women, to the front, putting uniforms on them. There seems to be a complete indifference on the part of the people around Zelensky to the loss of their lifeblood, to the loss of their manpower. So how can you negotiate with someone who is essentially sociopathic? Yeah. These people are sociopathic. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a huge dilemma for Russia. That they have assumed that Kyiv is a rational actor and that at a certain point in time, the realization would be brought home to Kyiv that, hey, you've lost this. It's time to cut your losses and negotiate. But these people are not rational. So once again, I come back to this dreadful choice that Putin faces. Do you go forward to a huge offensive war, which will obviously cause great suffering among the civilian population and the infrastructure right across Ukraine, or do you somehow wait and hope that something happens in Kiev? And I think for the moment, it seems to be a waiting game that Putin's people have decided to play.
Yeah, Stephen, what's your read on that? I also think, and I mean, it's kind of the way you want to phrase it. I mean, as long as you're not losing, you're winning. So that's a kind of a Russian interpretation of what's going on right now in light of this quote-unquote stalemate. Stephen.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it depends on manufacturers how long this is going to last for. And I think it will certainly go into 2024. And now the Washington has a dilemma, more precisely Biden's administration, because they came to realization that Russia is winning the war and that Ukraine is losing. But the question is whether they want to prolong this indefinitely with the aim of as many Russian soldiers and equipment being destroyed and people killed. It's a very cynical logic, but that's exactly what they are doing. However, Russia came out to be stronger now after 2 years of war. And on the other hand, you have the upcoming elections in the United States. By the way, there won't be most probably any elections in Ukraine because it's in war, and Zelensky doesn't need elections because it would show that he's not as strong as he pretends to be. So Washington has about a year to figure out what its stance is going to be about this, because as soon as Trump wins, and it seems to be an imminent result if the elections are to be held in November next year, the whole policy of Washington towards Eastern Europe, towards the European question, I would say, will change. So maybe the option of Washington would be to drag more of European countries into the war, and that would be the most tragic outcome for Europe.
I have to jump in here, but we can't. That is a real possibility with the people that we're dealing with here. Gentlemen, I have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine's options. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine's options. Okay, let's go to my favorite sparring partner, George in Budapest. Okay, we can put on the Peter and George show right now. And I'm going to tear a page from your script and use it against me. So what's all the problem here? I mean, the Russians are tied down. Ukraine is a huge headache for them. There's other things going on in the post-Soviet space, also a headache. Money is not going to dry up. I don't care how you do it. It's going to get there. And so, what's the big deal? Okay, look, Ukraine isn't winning, but it's not losing. The status quo is just fine. That's what you've been telling me for 20 months, George. Does ring true many times. Go ahead.
Well, I've been saying it, and I have to keep saying it. For the United States, this is still relatively a low-cost affair. it's sort of penny-ante stuff. I mean, America has trillions to burn, however, $100 billion, $200 billion. It doesn't mean a great deal for the United States, given the scale of its budget. As long as Americans are not dying, and as long as America can avoid getting into a direct shooting war with Russia, which is very, very serious, then America can keep it going. Now, the only caveat there, the only limitation is, can Ukraine keep it going? Can Ukraine go on without collapsing? And that's a possibility. Ukraine could indeed collapse, and then Biden's plans will be for naught. But at the moment, as they see it, as the Biden administration and the U.S. policymakers see it, this is a good deal because this is a headache for Russia. Russia doesn't know how to bring it to a satisfactory conclusion. They continue to lose lives. They continue to spend great resources. And they haven't yet made a decision to fully commit to this war, you know, to say, okay, well, we're now going to mobilize, we're going to really put our economy on a war footing, and we're going to just bring this war finally to a conclusion. They haven't made that decision. So as far as the Americans are concerned, well, go, let's keep it going. It's their headache, not ours.
Well, let's go back to the former ambassador in Australia. A variation on George's argument right there, actually it does apply to the Kiev regime. I mean, Zelensky and his inner circle, okay, maybe there won't be as much money, but it's still a lot of money. And as long as this conflict goes on, the U.S. is going to pay for it. Oh, and it's going to pay for its health care, its teachers and all that. I mean, okay, maybe we're not making much progress at the front, but, you know, the status quo, at least for the elites there, it's a good gig.
Yes, and can I add a nuance to what George just said? And that is, and it's very clear when you look at people like Lindsey Graham, for the right. United States, it's as good to be killing soldiers on the Ukrainian side as it is to be killing soldiers on the Russian side. And of course, a lot more soldiers are dying on the Ukrainian side by an order of magnitude. But you see, this is all part of weakening the Russian world. And if you're looking at it in cold, evil, I use the word evil advisedly, geopolitical terms, a weaker Ukraine in the long run means a weaker Russian world. So the weakening of Ukraine, if you're looking at it from a sociopathic point of view from Washington, is a good thing. It doesn't matter really which side has been weakened. I want to emphasize that because the sociopathy I mentioned of the Kiev elite is paralleled by the sociopathy of these sorts of people in Washington who are viscerally Russophobic. We won't go into the reasons why. They're historical and cultural and so on. And so, yeah, I mean, they will keep it going until something breaks in Kiev. And surely something must break in Kiev. I'm very impressed by the sort of human interest stories that are coming out all the time from a website that I'm impressed by called Ukraine Leaks, ENG. And, I mean, they produce so much color and movement on what's really happening. Something's got to break.
Well, you know, Stephen, that's one of the things that I've brought up, and actually George kind of already hinted towards it, is that Ukraine is facing societal collapse because it's completely financially dependent on donors in the West, okay? Its GDP is not worth talking about. It's indebted to its neck. The status quo is untenable for at least a long time. We have winter coming up, of course. It gets very cold there, like it does here in Russia. I mean, the political elites and the military elites, they may have their own designs, but society is going to continue to suffer. And we're going to still see people moving across the border into Europe. Stephen.
Exactly. I mean, to be quite frank, there is a big question whether Ukraine is going to survive in any shape and form at the end of this as a country. Because besides the war happening in the east and southeast of today's Ukraine, there are, of course, pretensions on the part of other countries on its western borders. At the same time, what I'm really concerned about is the possibility of the spreading of this war. And, you know, this sociopathic logic was just mentioned. And in that light, I just brought it up at the previous section, this statement by German Minister of Military, Boris Pistorius, who said that the German society should be prepared for a possibility of a war in Europe. I think this is really a scary a language that he is using. And I'm afraid that maybe Biden's administration might just want to let the Europeans deal with this thing and elegantly move towards other spots of the world complex. We see what is happening in the Middle East.
Stephen, I think it's quite interesting you said that because you could say that, which Tony told us the same thing about weakening the Russian world. I think that's really an interesting observation. But the Biden administration isn't bothered by a weakened Europe at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the result of this is that Europe is it became irrelevant, and you can see people like Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who openly said that recently in the light of the stance of Ursula von der Leyen and other European leaders towards what is happening in Gaza. So Europe is degraded as a power, and this especially goes for Germany and France, who were blindly constantly just fulfilling the wishes of Washington by sending all the weapons, all the money, all the aid for a war in which there is no clear goal that these countries have.
Yeah, well, they were weakened by design. Let's remember that, by design. George, over the last couple of days, we had the former head of NATO, Rasmussen, and another head, his name doesn't come to mind real quickly. They're all coming out with these newfangled ideas about how to change NATO, partial NATO, limited NATO. I mean, it's really quite astounding and scary because I guess they never read the first article of the NATO treaty, where you're not supposed to be starting military conflicts, okay? But by integrating Ukraine partially, what is that? Is that like partially pregnant? I don't really know what they're talking about. They sound like sociopaths to me. George.
They are sociopaths, yeah. Anders Fogh Rasmussen, and I think Admiral Stavridis,
there you go.
Former Supreme Allied Commander, and they're suggesting that, okay, well, we'll give up on some of the territories. Again, there's no basis for thinking that anyone in Kiev can just give up on territories. And then rump Ukraine can join NATO. But the idea is, of course, insane, because, of course, if the Russians realize that this rump Ukraine will become a member of NATO, Russia has every incentive to keep the war going and prevent this rump Ukraine becoming a member of NATO. And no one in NATO is going to accept a rump state that is perpetually at war with another state. I mean, that's the minimum condition that you have to fulfill to be a member of NATO. As you said, Article 1 says you cannot have any member of NATO that is involved in any kind of a conflict with a non-NATO member state. So if Ukraine were to rump Ukraine were to join NATO and still have claims on territory that is now part of Russian Federation, that you're violating Article 1, and no one in NATO is going to agree, essentially, to be in a de facto war against Russia. Well, maybe Annalena Baerbock, but I don't think anyone else is going to buy into it.
Well, I mean, let's go back to Australia. Tony, I mean, if there is a Ukraine in some limited way is brought into NATO and it's in a conflict with Russia, then why? What would stop the Russians from hitting Tallinn, Berlin, Washington? I mean, the alliance is at war with Russia. And this would be something that would be a choice, a craven choice on the part of NATO. Don't these people understand that they're courting World War III? Go ahead.
To be honest, I don't worry about the war extending into Europe. I think since that last crucial meeting of the NATO ministers, where Zelensky came and was humiliated a few months ago, I think that prospect has completely receded now. For better or worse, this thing is going to be settled within the present borders of Ukraine, one way or another.
Stephen, let me give you the last word before we end the program.
Yeah, well, I think that this situation is developing. What we know is that the war will continue and that Washington will continue to pay for it. Maybe they will send less aid, but recently we've seen F-16s being deployed to Romania from the Netherlands, and most probably Ukraine will get these planes. So the war will continue for some extent, but I think that it is more than clear that Russia is winning the war.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we'll have to have so much more waste of treasury and of lives for the outcome that was already predetermined on the first day of this conflict in February of last year. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Cambria, Belgrade, and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RTC. And next time, remember, crosstalk rules.